We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming to the program an actor and director. Well, you know him from his work in Animal House, those memorable Twisted Sister videos, Hill Street Blues, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Seinfeld, and much more. We're happy to welcome Mark Metcalf to the show. Hey, thanks so much for talking with us. And thanks to my friend Matt Damon, who claims that his wife is your cousin. Is he just making that up?
Well, yes, no, I don't know what she is. Her mother is my cousin. So I don't know if that makes her a cousin once removed, or a second cousin, or a niece cousin, or I don't know. But I've known her since she was just a few feet high.
And I also found out in doing a little research that you graduated from Westfield High School.
I did indeed.
And my father-in-law graduated from there the year after you.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
But I wonder, what was his name?
Tom Hayward. But he said he kept to himself. He was kind of nerdy in high school, and you probably wouldn't have known him.
Well, I felt nerdy. I think actually everybody feels like they're nerdy in high school. And so I don't remember the name, but my brother, it was in the class then behind him, 2 years behind me, my brother Roy Metcalf. And he may know him because he knows and remembers a lot more about high school than I do, because he hasn't done nearly as many drugs as I.
Now, you left Westfield. You went to the University of Michigan. And am I right that you were studying engineering when somebody said, hey, you ought to take one of these theater classes?
Yeah, my roommate said you should audition for these plays. They're doing the three parts of Henry VI by William Shakespeare. He said the girls are really friendly in the theater department, so come audition to these plays. They're going to need a lot of actors. You're sure to get a part. And I did get 13 different parts, 15 different parts, 13 different makeup changes and costume changes. All those kind of one-line parts that you get in Shakespeare where you just say, "Sir, the king is coming. You better kneel down," or something like that. So, yeah. So, but that was it. I was an engineer. I had changed to architecture from engineering when he asked me to do that. And it turned out he was right. The girls were friendlier, and it was a lot of fun being in plays.
And I
stayed.
And you were focused on stage work early in your career. Did you move to New York?
I moved to New York. I went, I had to get out of the war, Vietnam War, so I sort of danced around out here in the West. I'm in Oregon now, is where I live, and just hiding out. And then when I got out of the draft, I went back to Michigan and did plays, and where I went to college, as we said. I went and did plays, and when that was done, I got a job at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. I did a full season at Milwaukee Rep, and after that, I went to New York. And stayed in New York for 25 years, with side trips to L.A. and various places to do some film work and television. But I really refused to do television and film for the first 5 years I was in New York, from 71 to about 76. Well, and I just said no.
That, of course, changed in a big way with Animal House. But there's an interesting backstory there. I understand that you actually had met John Belushi while you were having a picnic in Central Park, is that right?
You've done some research. Yeah, I met John before he was John Belushi. I was having a picnic before we were going to see a play at the Delacorte Theater, Shakespeare in the Park, that Joe Papp does. I'd been in plays for Joe there, and a friend of mine, John Hurd, who's dead now, and his girlfriend, Patrizia Patriani, and my girlfriend, Pamela Reed, who's an actress, were having a picnic on the grass while we waited for the doors to open so we could go in. And this medium-sized, heavy, long-haired guy with a beard came lumbering across the grass towards us. And my friend John Hurd, who had been in Chicago, and his sister, Cordis, had done work for the Organic Theater in Chicago. So John had lived in Chicago for a little while, and he knew John Belushi, and he waved to him and said, "Hey, John, come on over here." So Belushi comes over, and we say, "Sit down, have some chicken, have some potato salad." Our girlfriends had made chicken and potato salad. We were having a classic American picnic. And what's going on? And he started talking about this audition that he had to have with a guy named Lorne Michaels for some sketch comedy, sketch comedy show that was going to be live on television every Saturday night. And he said, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do TV. Why should I do TV? It's the enemy. It's horrible. It's the system. And we said, John, they're going to pay you American money. And look, it's live. You can do anything you want. And so we talked for probably 20 minutes, 30 minutes, half an hour, whatever, about this thing. And he got up. He's still not having made up his mind whether he would do it or not. And lumbered away from us. And we realized at that moment that he'd eaten all the chicken and all the potato salad. It was all gone. While he was doing most of the talking, we would talk and try to convince him. How could you say no to something like this? And I don't think we had anything to do with him deciding to do it, but we at least had something to do with feeding him that day.
We had Karen Allen on our show a couple of years ago. She was absolutely delightful, and you got to know her on the plane out to Oregon.
Yep, exactly. I rode on the plane from New York out to Oregon. She must have taken a shuttle up from Washington, because I think she was living in Washington at the time, and we rode next to each other on the plane on the way out, and by the time I got to Oregon, I was madly in love with Karen Allen because she's so beautiful and, as you say, delightful. Yeah, she lives right near where you guys are in Fulver and Pittsfield.
Right, Mass. Yeah. Has her own business doing fiber arts over there?
Yeah, she went back to school and got a degree from Pratt or something like that and found some Japanese looms that she really liked, and she makes... she makes beautiful scarves and sweaters and hats and all kinds of whatever you can make on a loom. She makes it and sells it out of her, I guess, online, maybe out of a shop over there. Yeah, some really beautiful stuff.
We're talking with Mark Metcalf here on Downtown. We had Tim Matheson. Actually, he's been on a couple times with us. And he talked about how the deltas and the omegas were kept apart. But it was more than that. Can you tell the story of how John Landis welcomed you to Eugene, Oregon?
Yeah, I got off the plane, as I said, after riding out there with Karen Allen, and swooning over her, and went to the production manager's office to get my per diem. The first thing you do when you get on a movie set is get your per diem, just in case they change their minds. So you've got some cash to get out of town or to get drunk with. And Peter McGregor Scott, the production manager, said, leave your stuff here. John Landis is over in the coffee shop across the parking lot. He wants to see you. He's having lunch with some of the guys from the movie. So I walked across the parking lot, walked into this crowded coffee shop at the Roadway Inn in Springfield, Oregon, right outside of Eugene. And I see John at a big booth in the corner, surrounded by five or six guys, one of whom I knew, Bruce McGill, because he and I drank in some of the same bars in New York and were friends with a lot of the same people. And I had seen Peter Riegert before, so I saw them sitting at the table. And I walked over. John waved at me and said, come on over. So I walked over, and they're really happy to see me, it seems like. And I get to be about 10, 15 feet from the table, and Landis points at me and says, that's him. That's Niedermeyer. Get him. And they start throwing food at me and yelling at me and jeering at me and calling me all kinds of names. In the middle of this crowded restaurant. And so the line was drawn. It was clear that we were to be enemies, and we were to be on opposite camps. And we were. So I maintained that. And I was invited everywhere, but I always said no because I couldn't go to any of the parties with those guys. I tend to work sort of immersively 24/7 when I'm doing something like that. And I had the hotel. McGill, the long story is, McGill stole a piano from the lobby of this Roadway Inn and wheeled it across the parking lot and put it in his room, and his room became party central. And everybody would go there in the evenings after rapping and after dinner, or they'd have dinner there, and they'd sing songs, they'd play the piano, play guitars, do whatever people did in 1977 to have fun, including drinking and other chemicals, and just generally stayed there until 2:33 in the morning having a good time. I don't know how they managed to shoot the next day. But I had the hotel move my room to right above McGill's room. I knew I wouldn't be going to any of this, to Party Central. I had them move them to right above his room so that I would not be able to get any sleep because they'd be making the noise down there all night long. So I'd stay up studying my script, spit polishing my boots, and generally just sort of getting angrier and angrier at these guys. And then when I showed up on the set, I didn't have to sort of drum up the emotion. It was already there. But it's all in the name of fun.
Oh, yes.
It's all part of the game.
I'm a big fan of Doug Kenny's. Josh Carper wrote the book, mm-hmm. A Futile and Stupid Gesture, is a good friend of the show. And I understand that Doug helped you really find something in the character of Douglas Niedermeyer that maybe wasn't there on the script when he talked about his own brother.
Yeah, he told me that the character of Niedermeyer, he was basing it in a lot of ways on his brother. His brother had been a kind of the golden boy of the family, and Doug, as Josh talks about in the book, Netflix made it not a very good movie of that, what I think is actually a very good book. Of it, that they asked me to be in. I did a small part in it. But, and his brother, I can't remember if his brother committed suicide or died somehow young, but Doug had always felt, or it appeared to me that Doug had always felt sort of the, not the favored son, that his brother was the favored son, and he was working some of that into the character of Niedermeyer. At least that's what he said. But it gave me a sort of an emotional grounding in the character's all there on the page. Just when I got cast in it, McGill said that's the best acting part in the movie, and he's right. It was the most fun, most layered sort of acting part. You can put as much into it as you can find and get into it. So I was very lucky to get cast in that part. But, and Doug, I spent a lot of time with Doug, and he told me that. And he had some other scenes that were no longer in the script. One scene that I really always remembered and always wished we'd been able to shoot was Niedermeyer, and it's part of the inspiration for me polishing my boots and studying my script, but Niedermeyer with little metal toy soldiers acting out, say, the Battle of Gettysburg or some World War II battle, and bang, 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 doing all of the sounds, and it would have been a fun scene to sort of to improvise and to make up, but they had cut it because they didn't before they even put the script together. They cut it, but it was a good idea and gave me a good sense of who Niedermeyer was. He was at home alone, because I'm sure he was home alone all the time. His most intimate relationship was with his horse. And Doug, I spent, and Doug gave me that about his brother. Yeah.
After Animal House, you were cast in one of the most groundbreaking shows in television history, Hill Street Blues, and you had a chance for a longer term commitment, but you didn't want to get tied up.
Yeah, they asked me, when they first cast me, they asked me if I wanted to do a contract, and I didn't want to do a contract at the time. Because why? Because I didn't want to get tied up, exactly. I didn't want to do the same part over and over again. Because you sign those contracts, and they're for, I think, 5 years, and they want to get you, hooked in in case the thing goes, but I said no, so they still used me. They cast me in three parts, and three out of the first five episodes. And by the time we were shooting the third episode, I actually had changed my mind. It was fun to do. It was innovative enough. Most television is not really very interesting. But it was innovative enough, and I thought, well, this could be fun, even for 5 years, and it's a lot of money. So I said, I had my agent say, Mark would be interested in a contract now. But by that time, the character I'd created, that they'd given me, but that I'd created, had been established enough that ABC or NBC, I can't remember whatever
ABC
it was, said no. They don't want this character on all the time. He's a little bit too mean and nasty, too much of a misogynist, too much of a racist, too much of a horrible person. And they didn't want me they didn't want me then. But it was no big whoop to me because I had not wanted to do a season or even a full season to begin with. So the fact that they wanted me to have my throat cut by a hooker seemed just desserts for a guy like that.
You had never heard of Dee Snider or Twisted Sister until he called you up and asked you to be in a music video.
No, I didn't even have a television. I didn't know what MTV was. I stopped listening to popular music the day Beethoven died, and never paid much of any attention to hair bands or that kind of music. And he called me and asked me if I wanted to do this video and shoot it in California. I said, well, I'm doing a play. I'm off. I do a matinee on Sunday and no evening show, and I'm off Monday and I'm off Tuesday. I don't have to be there again until Wednesday evening. So if you can shoot it, if you can get me to California, shoot it in a day, get me back to New York so I can do this play, because I don't want to miss a performance of the play. Yeah, I'll go do this. I'll do it for you. I don't know what it is, but it's a trip to L.A., and I could use a trip. I always could use a trip to L.A. I left some stuff at a girlfriend's house out there, and I wanted to get it back. And so I went out there, and Dee met me at the airport. I'd never seen him before, and this big, ugly guy with long blonde hair met me, and he was like a big old puppy because he was so excited to meet Niedermeyer. They'd used they'd used lines that of mine in their bar show when they did bars up in the Hudson River because they loved the character, and he, on the way driving me to where I was going to be living, was what they didn't tell me. I didn't even ask him what they were going to be paying me, but what they didn't tell me is that they didn't have any place. They didn't have much money. They didn't have a place for me to live. So I slept on Marty Colliner's couch. Marty Colliner was the director who directed a lot of stuff for HBO. And Dee said, okay, this is what it is. It's like a Roadrunner cartoon, and you're Wile E. Coyote, and we're the Roadrunner, and we want you to write this stuff that you sort of scream at your son, and the only thing I'm going to tell you is it needs to end with what do you want to do with your life, because then the song starts with, I want to rock. And then they go into, we're not going to take it. So I went home and went to a friend of mine, Rex Weiner, who was a good friend, who was a writer. He created a character called Ford Fairlane.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew Dice Clay made it into a movie. And he and I sat around over a couple of beers and some food and hatched this monologue where I'm yelling at my son. And the only thing we were obligated to do, as I said, was to say, what do you want to do with your life at the end? So it was his line that came up with, I think, Rex's line. I carried an M16 in the war, and you carry that electric twanger, or whatever it is. But, yeah, and the rest is history. In fact, that's the only work of mine that my father was ever proud of. He didn't think it was respectable to be an actor. And he was only proud of it. I don't think he ever even saw it. He was proud of it because a friend of his read in the paper down in Pinehurst, North Carolina, where he'd retired, that Mark Metcalf and Dee Snider had been in the video of We're Not Going to Take It, had been played in its entirety on the floor of the Senate. Because Tipper Gore had used it as an example of sex and violence in rock and roll when she did her hearings on the same sex and violence in rock and roll. So my father was very proud that my work was in the Senate record book.
You had a wonderful turn as the master on Buffy. I can't even imagine. How long did it take to do that makeup?
Started out, it took 5 hours because they didn't quite know what the colors would be. It's a foam that's applied by medical adhesive to your face, and then there's a separate foam piece for the skull cap and the ears. Each ear is separate, and the neck piece. So those pieces, and then the fingernails. So it took all those pieces took a certain amount of time to apply, but they're very well made, and they were made ahead of time. But then at the beginning of the season, we didn't quite know what the colors should be. So they would put it on me and then paint it on me, and we'd consult about color and just general the impression of the face as we went along. By the end of the season, they had it down to about 3.5 hours. It took an hour and a half to get it off because they take it off very carefully so they don't take a layer of skin with it. But, yeah, so about 5 hours to put it on altogether.
And obviously, Joss liked your work and then brought you back an angel.
They brought me back an angel, and they brought me back in the third season, an episode called The Wish, I think it is, where somebody in the show wishes that Buffy had never come to Summerdale or whatever it's called. I didn't really watch the show. I just knew my part. But it's a world, the world is then, and she gets her wish for an episode. So the master is on the surface of the earth, and he's like the mayor of Summerdale. What is that town called? I don't know what it's called.
Sunnydale.
Oh, my God. Sunnydale. It is Sunnydale. Okay, it was close. Yeah, he's the mayor of Sunnydale and set up this factory where they run human bodies through this machine and siphons all the blood out and drink a lot of wine and or a lot of blood in fancy wine glasses. And it's a perfect world from the master. Yeah.
Very memorable term with two episodes on Seinfeld as the maestro. And I saw an interview where you said you weren't really a fan of the show, but you watched enough of it to get a feel for the style and the way they operated.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard to ignore Seinfeld. And it wasn't that I wasn't a fan of it. I just don't watch a lot of television. And I had a 3-year-old son at the time, so I was busy with him. But when I knew I was auditioning for it, I watched as many episodes as I could, just to sort of get a sense, because you want to get a sense. John Gielgud, the great English actor, said knowing style is knowing what kind of play you're in, and the same was true with television, especially with sitcoms. It's just knowing what the language is that they're talking. I mean, they're all talking English, obviously. I don't mean it that way, but I mean it, the language of how the people communicate. Third Rock from the Sun is a different language than Seinfeld. Friends is a slightly different language than Seinfeld, or a different language than Hill Street Blues. They're all different because of the source, which is the humans that are creating them. And you know, if I'm going to go work in a sitcom or a half hour drama, I need to know what the language is. Basically, it's the only way I can put it, just how they talk, people talk to each other. So yeah, I watched it and found it's a great show. I still don't watch TV, so I haven't. When people start talking Seinfeld, who are fans, they know every episode. And it's really amazing. I'm always impressed. And the same is true of Buffy. I mean, I do conventions now every once in a while where Buffy fans will come, and I'll sign autographs and take pictures with people, and it's fascinating how thorough the knowledge and the affection that people have for the world that Joss Whedon on Buffy created and that Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld created on Seinfeld. It's really fascinating.
Mark Metcalf is with us on Downtown. You had actually retired largely from the business. You were operating a restaurant. Can you explain the role that the First Stage Children's Theater out in Milwaukee had in getting you back into acting?
Yeah, I just had gotten bored with the stuff I was doing, even though it was good and smart stuff like Seinfeld and Buffy. And I quit the business in 2000. As I said, I had a son who in 2099 was 5 years old, I guess. And so my wife, the woman I was married to at the time, and I decided to get out of town. And she had been running all the food and beverage at Universal Studios, the commissary there. And she wasn't having a lot of fun, and I wasn't having a lot of fun. We weren't having a lot of fun. We thought we'd have more fun. We were misinformed. If we owned a restaurant. So I had some money, and I bought a restaurant in Milwaukee, which is where she was from. And we moved there and ran this restaurant together. She really ran it. I was what some friend of mine referred to as the kissable lips. I was the the front of the house guy. I was met people at the door and sat them and tried to act like I knew something about the restaurant business, which quickly became apparent that I didn't. And restaurant business is pretty intense, and it tore the marriage apart just because it's 24/7, and when you're putting a place together, the failure rate is like 96% of restaurants fail, even before coronavirus. And so it's you've got to pay a lot of attention to it. And she was really good. She really knew what she was doing. And but it didn't. It wasn't good for their marriage. That's what I did. And a guy named Rob Goodman, who was the artistic director and managing director of First Stage Children's Theater in Milwaukee, had seen me do a play in New York called Streamers years ago, and has really impressed. And when he heard that I was in town, and the local radio guys, as soon as they discovered that Niedermeyer was in town, they made a big deal out of it and had me on, which was fine. They were fun people. And also it put fannies in the seats at the restaurant. But anyway, Rob came up and said, I've got this play and I'd be interested in having you do it or read it at least. And I said, Rob, I don't want to do children's theater. I don't want to do ghosts and goblins and all that stuff. And he said, just read the play and tell me what you think about it. The play was called Einstein, Hero of the Mind. And it took Einstein from the time he was about 7 years old, when his teachers all thought he was slow, and because he didn't really talk very well, stammered a lot when he talked. And it took him from there up through the bomb on Hiroshima. And for 2 years after that, it was fairly common knowledge that Einstein had just lived in Princeton at the time and spent most every day alone in a rowboat on a little lake in Princeton, where I had done some plays down there, and I knew exactly the lake and knew the legend of Einstein in Princeton. And just trying to come to terms with his part in the making of the bomb on Hiroshima. And we did it with myself and a 14-year-old girl and 47 puppets, which were operated by six different actors. And it was a really phenomenal experience in the theater to work with kids and in front of kids and in front of their families and on a piece like this. And it really sort of woke me up again to why I'd originally gotten into theater, and the theater then led, because of money and opportunity and the way this country works, this culture works, it led to movies and TV. But I had to find my way back to the theater to remind myself why I'd done it, what I'd loved about it in the beginning, which is that relationship with an audience.
I work with high school actors here, and you put together a wonderful program for young actors and writers in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, I did. I put together, are you talking about collaborative cinema?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that I did for Milwaukee Film. Yeah, it was a really good program where we taught high school kids how to write for the cinema, for movies. And then we would pick the best. We'd get 50 submissions we could. We'd pick the top 50 and take them through a couple of workshops and whittle it down to the top 10. And then we'd pick the best of the 10, or our favorite of the 10 short films that these kids would write. And then we would make a movie out of it, and we would use them as crew and cast, and professional actors as cast and crew, and also students at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, which is a very, very good film school. They do primarily experimental film, so they were all chomping at the bit to do narrative, and we were all working on narrative. And we would make a film a year. I think I did it for about 6 years. I made a short film every year out of this program, and good films, made nice films that played at that festival, and played, some of them played at other festivals. And some of the kids that we took through this program are still working in the business and are pursuing careers and having active careers in the business.
You were also you were featured in a documentary recently that premiered at Sundance, Character, and as I understand, that's a film about typecasting and what happens to some actors who get pegged for certain types of roles.
Well, yeah, that's Vera Brunner-Sung, who's become a good friend, found out, I was introduced to her. She'd been in, lived in Missoula before me. We didn't know each other in Missoula, but she had moved to Columbus. And when I moved to Columbus, a friend of mine said, get in touch with Vera. So we had coffee and said hello and talked a lot, and we got along well. And she was a filmmaker, and she came back to me and said, I want to make a documentary about performance. So we talked for 6 hours, recorded my speech for 6 hours, not on film, just recording. She would ask me questions. It was like this kind of interview, only a little bit more in depth. And she would talk to me about my feelings about performance and my feelings about the theater and my feelings about movies and television and so on. And then out of that 6 hours of conversation, she picked a thread, a through line, and it's one of many through lines that are in there. But the through line that she tended to follow was my bitterness, my discontent with how I was seen in Hollywood. How when I did the Niedermeyer character, that became what people wanted of me. So I was always doing a version of that character. And which is not part of the reason I was bored, even though Niedermeyer, neither the maestro in Seinfeld nor the master in Buffy are really have threads of that Niedermeyer character. The master perhaps does, but the maestro doesn't really, other than his sense of persecution. Because people don't call him by as the mice. They don't recognize him in the same way that they recognize Leonard Bernstein. But anyway, so I mean, so they do carry some threads of it. But anyway, yeah, but that's the... I think the film's about... The short is called Character that did play at Sundance, played at the Big Sky Film Festival, was supposed to play at a lot of other festivals, but then coronavirus came along and it got... it got put on the shelf, or it's on hold until we're done with this, whatever this is, when we're done with it and we're back to behaving the way we used to behave, or in whatever new ways that we will behave. Maybe it'll show up, I don't know.
I sure hope so.
But it's a really nice little film, and it's about more than that, but the main thread of it, yes, is about my feelings of being typecast and I act out. It's a very experimental documentary, too, because it's not just me talking. It's me talking, but I'm not a talking head. We acted out a lot of just myself and Vera. We improvised and did work on, did put on some costumes, and we improvised all the visuals. What you see is all Vera's imagination and aided by my imagination. But the vocal, the audio is all those six, part of those 6 hours of me talking. It's only about 17 minutes long, I think, but it's a nice little short. It's good.
That's wonderful. Mark, thank you so much for your time today. It's been wonderful to talk with
you. That's all right.
Appreciate it. Maybe we'll do it again down the road.
Sure. Anytime. I'm happy to.